This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Bill Raggio, Foundation for Defense of Democracy Senior Fellow, is my colleague and co-host, and we're very, very pleased and privileged to welcome our Eyes on Iran, Jonathan Saya of FDD, watching the statements out of Tehran, but also this headline from the New York Times. This is an article by Stephen Erlanger, who has written about Iran for many years, a distinguished foreign policy reporter for the Times. I've talked to him many times over the years. The dangerous stalemate over Iran's nuclear program. Subhead: with no negotiations, no oversight, no clarity about Iran's stock of nuclear material, many in the region fear another war with Israel is inevitable. Jonathan, a very good evening to you. This is discouraging, but at the same time, it looks based on evidence. You hear the same thing, that the war is inevitable, that none of the issues that started the first round have been resolved. Good evening to you.
Good evening to you. How you describe the situation is really how the Iranians and Israelis see it. On one hand, Iranians think they were able to an extent, absorb a war, but they think they were a bit humiliated. So they would like another round where they can actually establish deterrence against Israel, unlike they did last time. Israelis, on the other hand, are of the opinion that Iran's nuclear program is still not fully destroyed in a sense that the uranium stockpile is there. But the Supreme Leader pointed at this a few months back when he said, we are in a position of no peace and no war. And that is what he described as dangerous for inside the country. It would contribute to the lack of morale internally when people don't know if another war is inevitable, but they know for a fact there's no peace either. So this stalemate, as you described it very accurately, is having a more psychological effect on the average Iranian and regime supporters.
Bill, you have a question for Jonathan.
Hello, John. According to the New York Times, Erlanger, Iranian officials told someone from the International Crisis Group that Iranian missile factories are basically operating 24 hours a day, and that if there's another war, they intend to fire 2,000 missiles at once, as opposed to metering it out like they did during the 12-day war with 500 missiles over that time period. Is this even possible for the Iranians, given their stockpiles now? The Israelis hit the launchers hard. Can the Iranians do this, or is this aspirational for them?
You're right to point out the word aspirational, in a sense that during the war, they saw their ballistic missile program to be really their only upper hand against Israel in their perspective. So they had armed these proxies throughout the years, and they thought that would act as a line of deterrence. That didn't really work out because Israel decapitated that leadership before the 12-day war. So if you look at their internal propaganda campaign, it's constantly talking about the ballistic missiles, like you mentioned. And when we talk about the 500 that was launched throughout the 12 days, it's important to note that over one night, I think it was about 200, which was the I think the first or the second night, that was the highest, and it gradually declined as the war went on. So during that war, from the Islamic Republic's perception, that was an existential crisis. So when they attacked Israel during that war, they thought they're going all out. That was their worst case crisis scenario, and they could not go beyond 200 a night, mostly because Israel had targeted the launchers and the manufacturing of these ballistic missiles. But we've noted previously that there is a silent shadow war going on, where we increasingly are seeing different mysterious fires and explosions happening across Iran, many of them at these facilities. So there is definitely a covert operation by Israel to ensure that Iran cannot re-up or re-stand its manufacturing capabilities in case there should be another conflict, which both sides see as inevitable.
The economy is broken. For some time now, I haven't even bothered quoting what the real gets per dollar. But the economy of the army, the state within a state, I can't see. Are they replenishing their coffers? Has trade changed in any direction? Are they selling more of anything?
We were optimistic that with the snapback sanctions, which was the full reimposition of UN Security Council sanctions, which China and Russia signed off on, that would directly limit Iran's oil exports. That would have a direct implication on the economy. And now, 2 months after snapback, we have not seen that. Not only have we not seen a decrease, we've seen a sharp increase in their oil exports. I think it's now 2.3 million barrels a day, which is significantly higher than Biden and drastically higher than the first Trump administration. Ultimately, it comes down to sanction enforcements, or lack thereof in this case. I think there's a perception in Washington that since the war, the Iran issue has been dealt with. After bombing their nuclear facilities and after Israel's attacks, the idea, at least within policymakers in the White House, is that we've put a cap, we've contained Iran in the short term, probably why they're not really going after these oil exports as much as they should. And the meeting that Trump had with Xi would have been a good opportunity for them to pressure China, given that they rely on energy so much from the Middle East, mostly from Iran. But ultimately, the numbers are higher. So when we talk about the average army or the average military person, they're definitely not benefiting from this. It goes to a very high-ranking inner circle of regime insiders that are effectively operating as kleptocrats or running the economy in the black market.
Bill, you have a question.
Yes, John. The president of Iran recently indicated that there was a problem, a water shortage he actually said, quote, we may have to evacuate Tehran if they don't get rain. How does domestic issues like this affect Iran's reestablishing its nuclear and missile program?
It directly links to any policy they have to make, because ultimately Tehran's crumbling is Iran's reckoning as a whole. So when we talk about water crisis, it's not just the water crisis in Iran. Of course, dams are drying up, and that has so much implication for the economy. Warehouses are shutting down, different industries are shutting down, but also that has a direct implication for power. There's a power crisis parallel to that, and on top of that, Tehran is very overcrowded. So this natural disasters that we're talking about around the country, that could have been prevented with proper management. It's not necessarily solely a natural disaster problem as much as its mismanagement, is happening all over, which means there's an influx of immigrants coming into Iran, coming into Tehran from different parts of the nation, southwest, northeast. And that, again, once you look at Tehran as a city, it doesn't look like the same Tehran from, let's say, 10 years ago. So as more and more people internally realize that they have no more options, because for many people, they think Tehran might be the land of opportunities. That is no longer the case. So we're reaching a point of desperation for the average Iranian. Now, if you're the regime official looking at the internal crisis that's going on, and you still choose to funnel and channel the same funds into a nuclear program or rearming your militias, then at one point, I think Iranian people are going to react like they have in the past, because they don't think they're being prioritized over the regime's regional ambitions and a nuclear program.
Quickly, my thinking right now is that Iran is in a contest with Turkey for regional hegemon. It would appear that Turkey is ahead. Is that a problem for Tehran? Do they have to catch up to Ankara? We have about a minute.
They have been trying to catch up for years now. But Syria is a great example of Iran's decline and Turkey's rise, because they've spent so much money and they killed over 500,000 people in Syria just to preserve Assad. And now that Assad is gone, effectively everybody has a stake in Syria except the Islamic Republic. You have Russians that are back, Americans never left, Turkey's increasing its presence, and so is Israel. The only player left out of this quagmire is the Islamic Republic. And that is just one example. If you look at Azerbaijan and Armenia, again, it was Turkey and America that really mediated and facilitated that. If you look at different parts of the world, whether it's North Africa, again, you see the decline of Iranian presence and an increase in Ankara's. But that mostly is limited to military endeavors. When we talk about the economy necessarily, there isn't that much of a competition between the two countries. Probably Saudi Arabia would be a more economic rival to the Islamic Republic, given that they compete over oil exports and gas exports with Qatar to an extent. But of course, Iran is sanctioned.
Catching up with Ankara. Is that what you said, Jonathan? Catching up with Ankara. They're chasing Ankara.
More so falling behind Ankara's foreign policy.
Jonathan Saya for the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Bill Raggio, FDD, a senior fellow. Keep the Long War Journal for Jonathan's reporting.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.